failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. Century of Lies is a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. I'm on the phone line with Rick Doblin. He's the executive director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies.
Well, it's tremendous news. We've actually started this effort in 1999 to end the NIDA monopoly and to try to get a license from DEA for our own marijuana production facility. And it's been, you know, almost 17 years now of effort. And finally, the DEA has agreed that they will end the NIDA monopoly, because as long as the NIDA monopoly existed, there was no way to make marijuana into an FDA-approved prescription medicine. And that's what's been so frustrating, that on the one hand, the federal government has said there's not enough evidence to reschedule marijuana, but on the other hand, they blocked the ability to get the evidence. And so now that DEA has said that they'll end the NIDA monopoly, that evidence can be gathered. But it's going to take 4 to 6 years. It could be $15 to $25 million to gather it. But at least it's possible now, whereas before it was not possible.
So 17 years. You've been trying to get them to do this for 17 years. They've been stonewalling you. They fought you in court. And they've said, why do you think they suddenly rolled over?
Well, I wouldn't say it's so suddenly. I mean, this monopoly, federal monopoly on the supply of federally legal marijuana has been in existence since 1968. So it's a 48-year process, really, that has been overturned by the ruling yesterday. And I think the reason that they finally said yes is because the world has changed. There's marijuana legalization states, there's medical marijuana states, the public is in favor of medical marijuana research. We've had multiple senators have been trying to influence the DEA to encourage them to end the NIDA monopoly. There's been enormous cultural changes, and also the DEA itself, I believe, is under pressure from the Obama administration. The Democratic political platform calls moving toward the legalization of marijuana. So there was absolutely no reason that the DEA could still use to justify keeping the NIDA monopoly going.
Well, as I said, there was bad news as well from DEA this week. In the same time that they're expanding the ability to cultivate for research purposes, they rejected two separate petitions calling for rescheduling. Could you comment on those for a moment?
Well, I don't think that that's bad news because they never were going to do that. It was a total fantasy that we could force the DEA through the legal system to go ahead and reschedule. It just wasn't going to happen. So, the reason that it was possible, you know, for people to delude themselves is there is a lot of evidence to suggest that marijuana has medical benefits, but there's not evidence from phase 3 studies, which is what is legally required to reschedule. And that gets us back to the monopoly. The National Institute on Drug Abuse that have the monopoly can legally provide marijuana for research, but they cannot provide marijuana as a legal prescription medicine for sale as a business. And the FDA requires the phase 3 studies be conducted with the exact same drug that the sponsor of the research is trying to market. So as long as the NIDA monopoly was in existence, FDA would never accept its marijuana for use in phase 3, and we could never get the data that was necessary to reschedule. So the fix was in, and there was really anybody realistically looking at this would know that the value of those petitions were to raise the issue in public consciousness, but they were never going to succeed. And they did raise the public consciousness, and they did help, and they just increased the pressure on DEA. And part of that now we see is that the NIDA monopoly is going to be ending, and it will be possible to generate the data for phase three, but it's going to take a long time, and it's going to take a lot of money, but it now can be done, whereas before it could not be done. So I don't see it as really bad news, because I never thought that it would happen in the first place, and I think that the petitions have achieved an important objective, which is they've eliminated the fundamental obstruction to getting the phase three data to rescheduling marijuana.
I must say I agree. I never took the prospect of their making a decision to change very seriously. Now, several outlets, some of the mainstream news outlets I've seen have been calling it a defeat for the marijuana legalizers, a defeat for reformers. Do you think that's just spin, like sort of a Kevin Sabet spin? Oh, look, I've won, kind of thing. Or where are they getting that?
Well, I think not everybody realized that there was no hope that these petitions would actually succeed. And they didn't understand that it was just part of an effort to pressure the federal government and to educate the public about these limitations. And then it's the change in public support that has influenced the politicians to pressure the DEA. So I think on the face of it, you could say, oh, yeah, now it looks like a defeat. But really, it's a tremendous success in that it pressured the DEA. It was one of the many things that helped pressure the DEA to end the monopoly.
Rick, do you have any closing thoughts for the listeners? And where can people find out more about the work you're doing? Give us your website, that kind of stuff.
Okay, the website is MAPS, M-A-P-S, like Maps of the World, MAPS.org. And I just want to briefly mention that we have a $2.1 million grant from the state of Colorado to study marijuana for post-traumatic stress disorder in 76 U.S. veterans. And we are using NIDA marijuana for that because at the moment there's no alternative, but that study will take place at Johns Hopkins and also in Phoenix, Arizona. And it'll take us a couple years to get the data, but we're very hopeful that we'll have promising data. And then we're going to, in the meantime, try to get a new source of marijuana other than NIDA, so that we can move into phase three studies in a couple years and actually make marijuana into an FDA-approved prescription medicine.
My heavens, thank you for reminding me that. That's the study you're doing with Sue Sisley, right? Are you folks recruiting people for that, research subjects for that yet?
We're not quite yet. We're waiting on, we've ordered the marijuana. NIDA will be sending the marijuana fairly soon. It's not exactly the marijuana that we requested, which was another reason that DEA has agreed to end the NIDA monopoly, because NIDA was not able to provide what we really needed. One of the strains will be 12% THC with virtually no CBD. Another will be 12% CBD and virtually no THC. And we asked for a 12% THC, 12% CBD combination, but the most that they could provide us was a 9% THC, 9% CBD. So, and then the other is going to be a placebo. So for people that might want to volunteer for the study, they will need to live either in the Baltimore area or in Phoenix, Arizona. And they will, the best thing to do is to actually keep in touch with our website, and we will have information there on how people can apply. So you just go to the research section and look at marijuana, and the information about the study and about how to apply to enroll will be there once we finally have the marijuana and are ready to start, which should be hopefully in a couple weeks.
Well, it sounds great. I realize you couldn't use it, but for what it's worth, I think the dispensary just down the street from me has weed with those percentages. Just saying.
Well, that's true. I mean, NIDA cannot provide what people need, and what people need is available. I mean, the fact that the top THC from NIDA is 12%, that's pathetic compared to what's available in a lot of other places. So, it's a really good step that's just taken place with DEA.
All right, well, I wish you all the best, and again, find out more information about all this, folks, by going to the MAPS website at maps.org. Rick, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Century of Lies, a production of the Drug Truth Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. On the phone now with my friend Lorenzo Jones. He is a community activist and organizer, formerly the executive director of a Better Way Foundation up in Connecticut. Lorenzo, you have a new project now, the Catal Center. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, how you doing? So I am the co-executive director with my co-director Gabriel Saya of the Catal Center for Health Equity and Justice. We just launched this year, February. Got a really lot of work on our plate. So we're working around three specific areas. The first would be we're working with Just Leadership, Glenn Martin, and Just Leadership around their efforts to close Rikers Prison, helping to train some organizers and make sure that campaign has some support. We're also working with the National Lead Support Bureau, which is headed up by Chris Nyrup and Lisa Dugard, right, from the Public Defenders Association. And we're working with them at Catal to pull together a project that would help municipalities look at bringing LEED type of diversion programs. And I should back off from diversion, but we don't want to be tricky with language. So what we're saying is that we want groups that are looking for, states and cities, municipalities specifically, looking for different ways to do, front-end diversion, where people are being moved into the public health system as opposed to being moved deeper or into the criminal justice system. And a more proactive way, looking at places where public health, healthcare, law enforcement, and criminal justice kind of intersect, in the world and in the new world of the Affordable Care Act, looking at those new intersections and how we can do front-end diversion on the ground in cities and keep people from going into the system by partnering with, public health, providers and professionals to divert people on the front end, for lack of a better word. So that's our second, and that's a pretty significant project and something we're taking really serious, and we think, it's going to give us an opportunity to do some, really significant and intimate community organizing on the ground in spaces where people may not be looking for new programs, but are looking for new public health strategies. We're not looking for necessarily new, a LEED program or looking for a diversion program as much as they're looking for new public health strategies across the board, period. How can services be delivered better to people who are directly impacted and have been, and families and communities that have been directly impacted by systemic oppression and the drug war?
This is really terrific news. The LEED program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, has had tremendous success in Washington State, up in Seattle area where it was originated. And you may be coming to Portland soon if you're doing work on LEED, because our Multnomah County District Attorney has recently been talking about wanting to create a LEED program here in Portland.
Yeah, we're looking at there are a number of places. We're still working out the different jurisdictions, but there are a number of places looking at LEED and LEED type programs. And again, right, the LEED stuff is important to us, obviously. We believe in it. We've seen it work. We know it can work. We've also seen some other difficulties, but not like any other program. But what we believe the LEED program enables us to kind of get into communities and actually talk to people about their direct interest in systemic change, right? And talking about something like healthcare and public health, especially among, and with people who are formerly incarcerated, directly impacted, and a number of other ways impacted by the war on drugs, mass incarceration, and a number of other issues. We believe that the LEED program, because it focuses on public health, it actually allows us to get beneath a lot of other problems and get to some core issues that people want to see addressed, like the actual delivery of services. Like, can we measure whether or not services are being delivered in our community, right? And do we have an expectation of what those services should be? So, for instance, in the LEAD program, we've tried to explain to people that it's not about working with the police, albeit that would be a positive thing for like communities, right? And for police. But that's, LEAD is not a fix-all to that. What LEAD is a way of allowing people to measure whether or not like the police and these new intersections of public health and healthcare and law enforcement, criminal justice reform, whether these new intersections are actually like producing things that are acceptable to the community. So if we can measure that by counting diversions that take place, we can measure that by counting diversions that don't take place. We can measure that by laying the same way we used to count hot spots and problem buildings, but we can count neighborhoods where we'll find concentrated populations of people who've been negatively impacted by, right, the war on drugs and mass incarceration. We can find people in those places, concentrated in those places, trying to deal with and navigate this system. LEAD gives us, I believe that we can use LEAD to help people to know and learn how to engage the system and learn how to then draw down from the system expectations around those services.
It's going to take a culture change within law enforcement, within the criminal justice system generally, to bring about some of this. I mean, here in Multnomah County, as I say, our district attorney is our county attorney's interested in LEAD. We've always had a progressive county attorney here in Multnomah County. Some parts of Oregon, not so much. In other parts of the country, not so much. We talk about community policing. What other kinds of approaches should we be doing to really have effective community policing?
So, early in my career, mid-late 90s, I actually worked as an organizer doing what at that time was called community policing. And so I've got a really interesting take on it, because the way we did community policing in Connecticut under the Clinton administration and Attorney Janet Reno, everything that's wrong with community policing is true. It's wrong with it. So like this increased contact with people. So let me back out of this a little bit and say it differently. So in order for community policing to work, you have to believe, and there has to actually be a reality of a relationship between the community and the police. So most times community policing gets rolled out. It is rolled out in a way that makes the assumption that the relationship is good or the relationship is going to be improved because of community policing. The problem with that, I guess, is that if we're going to, it's like, obviously the power dynamic is completely off. When you look in those same communities where you have concentrated folks who, right, have like negative relationships and negative like interactions and do not have a positive relationship with the system, that includes the police. Okay? So community policing done in a place where the relationship between the police and the community is positive, transparent, and accountable, game over, you got Mayberry. Community policing in a community where that relationship is not there, and worse, that relationship is in the negative, right? You have an occupying force that then gets every day, every shift gets deployed on a community of people who are going to respond to this external strategy called community policing, either by complying or not participating. So what we've seen in community policing, we've seen community policing work as a tagline and not work in places where those relationships are not solid. And those are not just communities and spaces where, you know, it's about race. Those are in spaces where it's about gender and it's about like immigration, it's about economics, it's about class. So the general moniker or the general like statement, community policing is good, is incomplete, because the community policing is good in communities where the people and the police have a relationship of account that includes accountability. Absence of accountability, right? The only people in that situation with power are the police. And it literally becomes community policing. It becomes the policing of the community.
Exactly. I've heard people talk about that police need to realize they are part of the community themselves. It's not a question of being an occupying army. This is, you know, we're all in the thing together, and that's a and when you don't have that, you get LA. You get cities where it's very much a them and us kind of situation. And that's
I don't think you get cities like that. Well, we have to get to a place where we understand that we have cities like that. What's happening here between the police, the relationship between the police and the community, it didn't get like this. It's always been like this in those communities. When you read and you talk to people, and I'm saying it's always been like that in Mayberry, and it's always been like that in the north end of Hartford. In that same time, the late 90s, during community policing, it was commonly talked about among the Hartford Police Department that North Hartford was the training ground. The black area of Hartford, black communities in Hartford, black including West Indian, Caribbean, right? And diverse, that it's Latino, right? It's right, the poor whites, that's the training ground. So if you were a cop in Hartford, you had to do so much time in North Hartford before you got certain other things inside the police department. Now, community policing made information like that available to us because we were meeting with and talking to the police all the time, and inevitably relationships were formed, and those relationships translated into like that kind of like inside information. But it did not translate into a better relationship with the people who were being trained on. So it didn't get like this. Like, it's been like this. Community policing was a response to it being like this, but community policing has not worked.
You're absolutely right. In fact, and I should know better. I've said the same thing when people talk about the drug war. It's like, oh yes, all these problems that are directly the cause, you know, that are, if we didn't have the drug war, all these problems would go away. It's like, no. The problems with racism and sexism and the classism existed before the drug war started. They were there before. The law enforcement was never the nice, friendly guy on the corner who was there to help. It was always there to essentially oppress and keep down the population groups that were disenfranchised and marginalized. It was always there to support the power structure. It's only been lately that we've been trying to remake it into that friendly guy on the corner who's there to help and protect and serve. Yeah, I know that. I do know that.
Well, in a completely strange, odd way, right? We, as well as we know that, who know it, right? There are legitimately people who don't know that. If you lived in Mayberry, you would be like, hey, community policing is great. Why would you not? So a lot of times, like, we lean into people or into places, or right, because legitimate ignorance. Like, if you lived in Mayberry, why would you have a negative opinion of like community policing? You could have a negative opinion of the police in Mayberry, and still dig community policing, right? The difference here is that while community policing does not work, which I want to retract that a little bit, and I'm not going to retract that, I'm going to add to it. Community policing does not work without accountability. If the police, and more importantly, the city, right, the municipality is not going to be and cannot be held accountable, then community policing will not work, right? And so what we see in different, what we look at are ways that we can change the system and we can reroute the system in some way, sometimes interrupt the system, right, disrupt this process in ways, right, that effectively, right, produce what the damn demand. And that's going to run contrary to a system that's primarily in place to protect itself. And it's easy to kind of it's easy to go down the road of like, this is a nefarious, sinister like plot, and this is like, you know, it's been like this since 1620, and it has, and since it's been like this since 1620, well, maybe 2020 we're talking about something else, we're doing something else, and then in 3120 they'll be doing whatever they're doing. So we don't have to have a solution. We just have to have an effective response to this situation right now in our era of advocacy.
Right on. Because it is an evolution. The culture has to change, and then the laws can change. But they do change. And that's the thing.
They're changed. They don't change. We change them. That's that interruption, that responsible disruption of advocates, organizers, and activists. That the question is, well, is community policing good or is community policing bad? That's the question that's asked. And then everybody kind of gravitates and like works around that question, when the real question is, what's good for people in communities? Policing is only one thing in that community. There's sewage, there's water services, there's license inspection, there's crossing guards, there's like libraries. There's a bunch of things that the people in that community should be answering that question on. Instead, what have we done? Community policing has taken all of that and put it in a light, nice little ball. And, you know, our midget football teams are funded through the police department. You know, our, you know, police department, you know, at one point, like a police officer was like employee of the month at the Harvard Board of Education. Like, how did that happen? How's a community service officer the employee of the month at the Harvard Board of Education? I mean, this was years, it's a decade or so ago, but it gives you an idea of like where we were a decade ago, right? So to me, 2020 got to be different than 1620. I don't know if we have any more responsibility than that, and I don't know if that includes community policing or not. I do know it includes community, and the community should determine what kind of policing they're dealing with.
Lorenzo, any closing thoughts for the listeners, and thank you for the time, by the way, and closing thoughts for listeners, and also where can people find out more about the work that you're doing, a website and all that stuff?
Yeah, people can find more about us at katalcenter.org, 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 and myself, my co-director, both of us are available to you know, meet with folks, talk with folks. Like, we're working with people across the country and just trying to have a really in-depth conversation around, you know, where we are right now, you know, and where we want to be. Not necessarily where we're going, but where we want to be. So I thank you for the time today.
This year's HempFest is August 19th, 20th, and 21st in Seattle, Washington. Information, maps, schedule, and a lot more at their website, hempfest.org. And well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. We'll be back next week with 30 minutes of news and information about the drug war and this century of lies. For now, for the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.